this is Andrea Combs in the studio for From the Frontline. Today we are dealing with when disaster struck the Great Penguin Rescue 20 years ago. In the Frontline studio, I'm interviewing my father, Dr. Peter Hammond, who was part of this event 20 years ago. This event is still the biggest animal rescue operation in world history today. So tell us the background on this historic event. How did this disaster occur?
Well, it actually happened in slow motion. We could see it happening for about 2 weeks to come. There was this MV Treasure, a Chinese bulk ore carrier, which developed metal fatigue with an 18-meter wide hole in the hull. How on earth does a ship get an 18-meter wide hole in the hull? I mean, gross negligence of the highest order. And people were talking about this in the South Atlantic. We're going to have to get the oil off. Well, who's going to pay for that? And we need to get the crew off. Some people even said, get the crew off and then get the Navy to go and incinerate this thing and burn up all the oil before it comes and pollutes our shores. So there's all sorts of things, but nobody did anything. Governments did nothing. The Chinese government did nothing. The South African government did nothing. The owners of the boat did nothing. And next thing they're talking about, we must tow this ship into Table Bay Harbor. Well, immediately, a whole lot of knowledgeable Cape Townians said, it'll never fit in the harbor. The ship's too big. It's too wide. It'll never fit. And sure enough, it didn't fit. But that by that point, they'd brought the ship virtually into Table Bay. It couldn't fit in the harbor, which everyone could tell them a week ahead. And at this point, the ship's captain and crew abandoned the ship. The ship started to drift towards the nuclear power station at Kuberg's saltwater intakes. And at that point, a Navy group was sent off to drop divers on and by helicopter and steer the ship away from the saltwater intakes of the nuclear power station. And it sank just off the coast of Table Bay. And the oil was going straight to Robben Island. And it was an absolute catastrophe. And everyone knew it was coming. And the authorities and the owners did nothing to prevent it.
That sounds terrifying. I didn't realize all those details that led up to that. Ugh, that's horrible. So this isn't the first time, though, that we've experienced an oil spill in the Cape. How did it compare to the sinking of the MV Apollo C in 1994? Which at that point had been the worst oil spill to take place on Cape shores prior to this.
Indeed. So 6 years before, June 1994, we had a terrible storm. Very, very, very big storm. In fact, I remember it with trees down across Forest Drive and fire brigade called out to saw through trees and cars that were trapped and people trapped in homes. So it was a big storm. And in the storm, the MV Apollo C, which was owned by the very same Chinese company who's responsible for the MV Treasure, they received an SOS from their ship and didn't bother to inform South Africa. The National Sea Rescue Institute wasn't informed. No one did anything. All hands lost. Ship went down. Nobody knows about this because China said nothing. The company says nothing. Nobody in South Africa knows about it. And next thing, the Sandcorp representatives on Dusan Island start seeing oil coming up on Dusan Island. And it was, where's this oil coming from? So people said, well, maybe the storm dislocated an old shipwreck and some oil's coming. But more and more oil kept coming. And of course, if we'd known what the problem was ahead of time, if the ship's captain had SOS'd us in South Africa instead of home base in China, I mean, there's a lot of if-onlys. Mm-hmm. But at this point, Sandcob, which is designed to rescue seabirds, suddenly was overwhelmed. And they'd never coped with more than 100 or so at a time. And suddenly there were a vast amount, 10,000 penguins were oiled in this 1994 disaster. And we were slipping and sliding on the oil. You can just imagine oil on rocks, terrible combination. And by the time we got the seabirds, because we responded too late. I mean, disaster had already been going for so long when they called for nobody knew this was happening. And so all the birds were oiled on Dusan Island, which is at least 10,000, and they not only had oil on their fur, but they had oil in their systems. Many of them had ingested it. The food was, of course, polluted. So they were either going to die of starvation or die from kidney failure and everything else if they ate oil-infected fish. And, of course, the water, they were without hydration. By the time we got many of these penguins, they were, these penguins were meant to be 2.5-3 kilograms each. Some were down to 1.2 kilograms, half their body weight, dehydrated, really bad. So this was a disaster of the highest magnitude. And I'd never handled penguins before. But I was one of the Cape Townians who rushed in, and we closed our mission. Rondebosch dashed off everyone who could. And we joined many other Cape Townians trying to clean and feed the penguins, which was quite an operation, especially as we weren't trained. We didn't really have much of a clue what we were doing. We didn't have good equipment. We had no real body protection equipment. I got every one of my fingers cut by these razor-sharp beaks of these penguins. And I must say that nearly lost an eye as well with reaching down after dropping a... It's easy to drop fish. Trying to feed him fish, and I came in range with this penguin who tried to take a chunk out of me to show his self-respect, because, hey, penguins swim with whales, sharks, seals. They're not afraid of puny human beings. So these penguins, they might be birds, but they're a bit like cats in the sense that they're feisty, they've got their own minds, and they won't do what they're told. They've got their own independent characters.
Fair enough.
So, yes, and I had no idea how strong their flippers were. But, of course, they swim with their flippers, so it's not just like a bird's wing. Their flippers can really hurt. And so to learn to pin them between your knees with the flippers down and get that mouth open and get the fish in. So it was quite an experience to learn. And we didn't have enough buckets. We didn't have enough water. There wasn't enough hose pipes. There wasn't enough people. And back then, we were foolish enough to think one person could clean a penguin and one person could feed. We discovered later you need two people to clean a penguin. Mm. But back in 94, we were still very much learning, and it was unbelievable operation. The oil, of course, not only was threatening their lives, but also they couldn't be released in a while until they'd rebuilt their natural oils, which made them waterproof. And, of course, penguins might be birds, but they don't fly, they swim. And they've got an interlocking kind of Velcro type of feather system with their natural oils, which makes them completely waterproof. Now, this oil that had been leaked from the ship, that would get between the Velcro system, destroy their natural oils, and make them able to be waterlogged, drown, or die of hypothermia of cold. So super important. We had to clean the penguins. Mm. We had to introduce medicine to those with ingested oil, which sadly was most of them, and of course give them a food. So that was quite an operation, cleaning, feeding, giving medicine, and then getting them into a place where they could be warm. You'd have to put little heaters out because they didn't have natural...
It would have been very cold in June.
This was winter. It was stormy, rainy. So that was quite an operation. That was my introduction to penguin rescue and to the work of SANCOB.
Well, clearly there was a very steep learning curve in this experience. So having gained all that experience from rescuing these poor penguins back in 94, what impact did this have on the rescue efforts in 2000?
Yes, well, I must say that like many of us in 94, we reached the end. I mean, this was totally undermanned. This was totally underfunded. We were completely under-equipped. We didn't have goggles to protect our eyes. We didn't have proper gloves. We were wearing some kind of overalls, which actually got hacked to pieces with penguin bites too. We didn't have enough of anything, actually, and we're using just normal dishwashing liquid. Now, interestingly enough, by the time we came to the 2000 rescue, some teenager, not yet out of high school, designed a degreaser, which was the primary degreaser we used in the year 2000, which was far better than sunlight liquid in getting rid of the grease and far more friendly to the
wow.
penguins. And wonderful to think that, you know, you could have some homeschooled techno geek who designed something in his teens, which literally was used to save 40,000 penguins later.
Do we know what inspired this creation?
Yes, the penguin rescue in 94, just recognizing we don't have the right... sunlight liquid, it did the job, but it wasn't specifically designed for animal rescues. It was just we needed some degreaser, and that wasn't the best. But
incredible.
The one in 2000 was superb,
wow.
and it worked well. So what I think the biggest lessons, there were a lot of lessons. One of the lessons was the transportation of penguins wasn't adequate. Some penguins died from lack of adequate oxygen being transported in boxes to being released. So they realized the first thing is we need proper designed cardboard boxes with enough ventilation holes. And those were made in time for the transporting of the penguins, both from the beaches and later back to the beaches, so before cleaning and after cleaning. So I think the transportation, that was one of the best. The degreaser, another outstanding one. Also, we had learned you can't use volunteers who haven't been trained. And so the training was done, but there weren't that many experts in how to handle penguins. And so Sancob, on the first day, we're talking about now 23 June, year 2000, the disasters here, Sancob sent out the alert. Everyone knows penguins worldwide, we need you. They came from SeaWorld, they came from the zoos, they came from anyone who knew anything about penguins. I think there's 197 foreign international wildlife experts, most of which knew penguins, who came down and they trained us. And so everybody, without exception, we're talking about 45,000 volunteers that were mobilized.
Wow.
And that's not too many, because remember, we were dealing with 40,000 penguins that were at risk in the year 2000. So we needed all these volunteers. And to be honest, it took two people 1 to 2 hours, 1.5 to 2 hours to clean one penguin. I mean, it's very labor intensive, because first of all, they showed that our slapdash approach back in 94 wasn't good enough. There mustn't be one iota of oil. You've got to get all of it off, or there's going to be problems down the road. You know, everything from kidney failures and others. So the cleaning, and we didn't just clean outside of the penguin. Now we use toothbrushes and little Q-tips and so on to get in the mouth and get all little oil that's in the mouth and so on, and by the gills and not there, not gills, by the beaks and so on. So the cleaning was far more thorough, and there were always two people attached. Now we had enough buckets and we had enough, and there was the special degreaser, which we ran out of partway, and they had to quickly go into more production, because this was industrial level, colossal level. And with all the volunteers that we had there, and you think of the time it took to feed the penguins as well. So it was a 24-hour a day, continual shifts coming in. You never had enough people. You know, at the time, I must say, it was like you dreamed of penguins. You woke up with just penguins, more penguins. It was complete, just lived in a world of penguins. And that you wouldn't... I think every one of us is involved. We lost weight because, you know, you couldn't take time off to get food. You didn't have time off to go to the bathroom. Didn't have time to... there's more penguins. Every minute counted. And these little guys are dying of hypothermia. They need food. They need medicine. And how Cape Tonians responded, it was just phenomenal. Many businesses, like our mission, just closed the doors and everyone rushed off to volunteer to Sancob. And, of course, the people who flew from all over the world. So it was a remarkable experience. I'd say the better training, better equipment, we had much better gloves. In fact, I had only one bruised thumb in the year 2000, penguin rescue, and one peck on the cheek. But whereas every finger had been lacerated in 94 because I didn't have proper gloves or any other protections. So just there was no doubt about it that the operation was better organized, and to do it, the logistics was colossal. So they actually took a big, massive railway, what do we call it, a warehouse. And an observatory. And this covered 5 acres of covered space, and that's where they put lots of porta pools and so on. And then outside, they had an additional 6 acres that was used for pens and pools to house the birds after they'd been cleaned. So inside, we'd clean them, give them initial feeding. And to give you an idea of the operation, how big it was, we were feeding the birds 10 tons of fish a day, 10 tons. 7,000 tons of beach sand was brought in for the bird pens that we had in observatory. 7,600 litres of the special degreaser detergent we used, 7,600 litres. And we fed 400 tons of fish to the birds that were in that observatory facility. So it was...
Wow.
And when you bear in mind, it's all totally independent, all organised by volunteers, no government funding. This is just Cape Town volunteers and people from around the world who rushed over here.
And generous donations, I'm assuming?
There were. I&J donated a lot of fish, and, you know, there were different groups who donated things. And it, you could just see shops all around Cape Town putting up bins for people to put in blankets for the penguins and towels. And because, obviously, they're all, we need to organize heaters for them. It was, again, middle of winter, massive operation.
Yes, I was only 3 years old when the first big oil spill took place in 94, but I'll never forget seeing the many volunteers clad in yellow oilskin suits and assisting in the rehabilitation of all these penguins. And the experience taught me from a young age the importance of caring for those who can't help themselves. And with the spill in 2000, I remember being there with my cousin, helping clean out those pools so that the penguins could go in after they'd been cleaned. And I remember seeing how happy they were to be in water again after being tortured by these cruel humans and being very upset that I wasn't allowed to swim with these penguins. So that is a memory I keep with me today.
Yes, that's a bit rough. You even promised by somebody that you'd be able to swim with the penguins, and then someone else was on shift and said, oh, no, you can't do that.
When
you'd actually cleaned it out.
Now, you had mentioned sand cob earlier. Could you explain who they are?
Yes,
what that means?
So sand cob is the South African National Coastal Birds Organization, Southern African Foundation for the Conservation of Coastal Birds. They started in Newlands in 1967 by a housewife who was concerned, and she was caring for the penguins in a bath, and son who had been oiled from different ships coming past. And so what she started just in her home built into this now world-renowned expert. And in fact, no organization worldwide has the experience and insights and even the facilities as Sandcop now has in dealing with coastal birds. And of course, it's not just penguins. Penguins are the biggest part, but we're also rescuing cormorants. And there were some seagulls. There was a whole range of other coastal birds who were affected, but penguins were the main focus. And they've had a lot of flamingos in there too on occasion. And so sand cob is coastal birds. And while we think particularly of penguins, but they're based now in Milnerton. They've got a phenomenal facility there now. It was not that good a facility when we were there in 94. It was, bunch of prefabs and a few pools, but now it's really state-of-the-art, top class. You can go there, and they've got, for example, not just beautiful facilities for the penguins, but the cleaning facilities are a dream. Actual basins at the correct height. You're not sort of getting permanent backaches stooping over. They've got with the hose pipes, with all the different attachments. They've got the counters where you can be cleaning and so on. They've got the cleaning room, the rinsing room, the drying room with the heaters and so on, and then they're going straight out into where they're fed. And so now that it's just so well organized, and even the mats, non-slip type mats, we did a lot of slipping, going up and down the ramps, and so that you can, and the beautiful pools, absolutely magnificent. And the way they've organized it too, today they've got a colossal water purification system because the cost of water during our water problems. So they got themselves a borehole, they got all these different filtering systems, and they process, we're talking about millions of litres a year. It's just a tremendous operation. So sand cob has grown a lot since the early volunteer times in 94, but already in the year 2000 they were getting really top class. But now people come to sand cob from around the world to learn how to rescue seabirds.
Wow. So clearly these tragedies have brought forth something really good.
Yes.
And should, Lord forbid, there is another oil spill in the future, they'll be more prepared for it, right?
Yes, and one also needs to say that when this oil spill happened in the year 2000, now, I should add that in the Apollo Sea disaster of 1994, we only saved half of the penguins that we rescued. Only half were able to survive the trauma of everything and be reintroduced in the wild. So a 50% success rate at that stage was the best ever. When the disaster happened, and with the two main African penguin colonies in the world being Dusson Island and Robben Island, and Robben Island was oiled almost immediately. So we had 20,000 penguins, of which 6,000 were chicks who had just been hatched, oiled. This was a catastrophe of the first order. and there were cabinet ministers saying we must euthanize all the oiled birds because there's no chance of anything like that. They believed, and some people are giving statistics, even internationally, that only 1% to 2% of the oiled birds will ever be able to rehabilitate it. And we were saying, well, we managed to save 50% of them back in 94, and we'll do a lot better this time. And of course, Sandcobb and others were absolutely outraged at the suggestion of euthanizing oiled birds. They deserved a second chance. And it's not the animals who caused this disaster. Humans caused this disaster. We were morally obligated to resolve this problem.
Scripture tells us to care for our animals.
Indeed. A good man is kind to his animals. The wicked are cruel to theirs. Proverbs 12, verse 10. So we were determined we will save these birds, every last one that we possibly can. And of course, the obstacles that we were facing was colossal. So to get an idea of what we were dealing with, the divers confirmed that the ship suffered structural damage. The oil was rising from the cracks in the hull. The engine room vents were leaking a steady stream of oil. And this is bunker oil, which is the worst kind of oil. It's the darkest, thickest. It's because bunker oil is fuel oil. It's what remains after lighter fractions of gasoline, kerosene, diesel have been removed by distillation. So the hideous materials in crude petroleum that aren't distilled as the boiling point's too high to be conventionally recovered. So this bunker oil is so dense and it's such a serious contaminant, it's the worst kind of oil for a spill. And they had spilled 1,300 tons of bunker oil before the divers managed to seal off the oil wreckages from the wreck. And within 3 days of the sinking, dive teams had sealed off all leaks from the ship. But now, of course, cleaning up the kelp that was covered in oil, vacuuming up the pools of oil with specially designed vacuums, booms were constructed to keep the oil from reaching Table Bay Harbor and other parts. There was a Southern company, Biometrics, that was developing systems of how to clean up oil slicks, which actually worked very effectively. But as we were, we'd gotten 20,000 penguins who were already oiled. But there was another 20,000 at Dawson Island who were endangered, and the oil is heading for them. That's where the current's going. And there was this overwhelming sense of we can't cope. And the sense of doom was just overwhelming because we couldn't manage the 20,000 we had. And yet more and more volunteers kept coming. Some genius had this idea. Well, why don't we capture the penguins before the oil gets there and relocate them? But where could we accommodate them? And, you know, again, you're talking about how many tons of food and everything else, sand and everything that's got to be more and more porta pools. And one person said, well, why don't we just drive them up the coast and drop them into the ocean at Port Elizabeth, where there's another Sandcobb facility. And then they can swim back and they can feed themselves as they swim back. And that should take them at least 2 weeks to swim back the 800 kilometers to Dawson Island. And apparently penguins have a phenomenal homing system. Mm-hmm. And just to track this and to prove their theory, they selected three penguins named Peter, Percy, and Pamela Penguin with GPS tracking devices that were strapped on them so they could monitor their representative travels. And incredibly, yes, it took them 14 days to get back, which is amazing. And by the time they got back, Biometrics and so on had cleaned up Dawson Island, and they were able to come right back to their correct nesting facilities. Now, of course, penguins, you know, also mate for life, and they're inflexibly loyal to their partner. So one of the problems was you didn't want to separate out families, and of course that must have been done in the catching of them. And so before they were released, they were first put in big Air Force hangars where they could walk around and find one another, find their families, and then they were then grouped together. One said, obviously, you know, this is this family, and so on. And that was done on both sides, both the ones who were oiled and the ones who weren't, that had to give them a chance to find one another. Mm-hmm. Because they've come across penguins who swim all over trying to find their mates. And it's just amazing how God's made them, that they can find their way across the seas without, you know, we need GPSs and radio and maps and so on, but these penguins, like the birds who fly, they've got a homing device. Very intriguing.
Incredible.
So this was probably one of the most brilliant ideas of the whole thing too, was why try to confine restrict, imprison 20,000 penguins who haven't been oiled. Why put them through that trauma? Rather the travel, okay, that's a bit of a trauma, but then they're in the ocean and now they're free. And they're in their natural habitat and they'll get back. So the relocation was of 19,500 penguins from Dustin Island, almost 20,000. And they made it back. So that was phenomenally successful. The relocation was, that took half our work away. It was like, what a genius idea. And nobody had ever done this or thought of this before. And so this, of course, has guided other oil disasters like this happened off Chile or Alaska since it. That if they're not oiled, don't bother confining them. Move them to another place and they'll swim back.
Amazing. Do you know of anyone who's gone to check on them since to see if there are any long-term issues or if they're still doing
Oh,
well?
Very much so. So Dustin Island and Robben Island have regular monitors to protect and to watch and to see. First of all, that people don't interfere and to monitor if there's any oil slicks or other problems.
So do you mean cameras?
They've got cameras, they've got different monitors, but they've also got people placed on these islands. And, you know, where we've got king penguins, for example, on Prince Edward Island, which is a much bigger penguin, there's emperor penguins on out in Antarctica, but there's king penguins on Prince Edward Island, also South African Island, and there are people specifically designated to, they're doing scientific research, and these are serious animal specialists. So similarly, Sandcop's got people placed on Dustin Island and Robben Island for that very purpose. And all of the penguins that we rescued got a little ring with a number attached onto their wing. And so we could tell, for example, some of the penguins we were dealing with on the rescue in 2000 had rings from the 94. And those ones were the most cooperative. They knew how to take the fish and they were a problem. So evidently...
They were the veterans.
Evidently, penguins learn from experience too.
Incredible. You know, when you first think about an oil spill, you can't even begin to fathom all the different challenges that you have to face, such as just the supplies alone of the food, the cleaning supplies, and the volunteers. Usually volunteers are the first thing you think about, but what an enormous operation. And I can just imagine that Capetonians must have felt very bolstered with all of the international help and probably encouraged some locals to help too, right? Because if people are flying around the world to come and help, then this must be a pretty big deal. So did you find the community?
Oh, I think the community spirit, to me, yes. I think this is one of Cape Town's finest hours. The central national government failed us. Provincial government failed us. Municipal government failed us, actually. And so normal citizens took the challenge and rallied. And I think it was a very empowering thing to discover we're not helpless victims dependent on some government or international foreign aid to be able to achieve things. What we did, just simple volunteers, and you had everything from medical doctors, teachers, housewives, children, people from all walks of life, plumbers, electricians. There was just such a pooling of, you're sitting next to all sorts. I mean, just one example is my Austrian sister-in-law. She's a professor. And here's my sister-in-law on her first visit to Africa, from Salzburg, Austria, so my wife's elder sister, your aunt. And so when Professor Deborah Peltzman first arrived at Cape Town Airport, I said, Debbie, we've got a crisis. We need to go and rescue penguins. And no hesitation on her side. And soon there's Professor Peltzman dressed in her oilskins. First visit to Africa, first day, hasn't even had a chance to sleep off jet lag or anything. And she's scrubbing penguins, feeding penguins. And I've actually got her... I asked her for her recollection. So here's what my sister-in-law writes. I specifically remember how well organized the feeding was. Each volunteer group, mostly three people, was in a pen with two smaller pens to left and right. One of the smaller pens housed approximately 20 hungry penguins. We had to pick up a penguin in the correct manner, keeping your chin up and your eyes out of the way of his beak, and position animal between your legs, keeping ankles crossed, efficiently keeping the wings pinned between your knees so that they could not be damaged and so that you could also control them from not damaging you. We had to feed each penguin six fish at each feeding, three fish with medicine. In fact, this was something also learned in 94 was when we were trying to get a tablet down their mouth and They knew how to expel it, just like our cats can do, very resistant. But somebody then pointed out, well, just put the medicine inside a fish's mouth, open the fish mouth, put that in, and then they'll take the fish. And why didn't I think of that? I mean, that's a good idea. So back to the quote. That done, the penguin was then carefully put in the other smaller pens so you could keep track of who'd been fed and who had not. Each volunteer had to keep calm, collected, mostly quiet, giving the animals a sense of security and not adding to their stress. I also remember every grocery store in Cape Town had a storage bin into which people could donate towels to help clean the animals. What a fabulous experience it was, not to be missed. Thank you. The downside, I remember Peter's car reeking of fish. Well, actually, I don't remember that. I think
you're probably so used to the smell at that point.
We were so used to the smell of fish. And who knows what we all smelled like because we were handling fish and penguins all day.
You had mentioned there being about 19,000 that went up to the eastern.
19,500 Dustin Island penguins caught before they were oiled, transported up, and they swam back on their own accord.
So how many were estimated for the Cape that stayed there?
Well, we got more than 20,000 who came and who were oiled from, that's from Robben Island. And
so we're talking about 40,000 penguins that were affected.
And that included 6,000 chicks, the biggest breeding season in recorded history in our lifetime of penguins in South Africa. So it was a double blow that this was not just affecting the two biggest colonies of penguins, African penguins in the world, but it was a whole lot of chicks, which was a far bigger disaster because this is the future of the penguins, African penguins in Africa. And so we know a lot of people who actually adopted these little fluffy penguins and had them in their homes and so on. And I met some of these people just recently who were the foster parents of the little ones who later got reintroduced back in the hangars to find their parents. And by that time, they now had their, now they're waterproofing back. Mm-hmm. So phenomenal, the whole operation. And yes, as a volunteer, you arrived there and we didn't all understand how much had gone behind the scenes to get the equipment, to get the porta pools, the fish donated, the buckets, the brushes. And it wasn't just big brushes, it was down to toothbrushes, because especially when you were getting in their mouths and getting some of the hard to reach areas, we were down to toothbrushes and who had designed the degreaser. And so there was a lot of things behind the scenes, the logistics, the drivers, the people who assembled all these cardboard boxes, specially ventilated, designed for transporting the penguins. So this was really a team effort.
Absolutely. And you had mentioned it was a 24-hour job, people taking shifts. So people must have undoubtedly taken time off of work to be able to do this.
Yes, I think we all lost track of time. I don't even remember knowing what the time was. And sometimes I remember coming out being astounded. It's pitch dark outside. Gee, have we been in here that long? I had no idea. So you lost all track of time. It was just it sort of reminded me of this Volrod Voltimard, Rescue the Perishing, once more. Let's save two more. And this vision, and the song Rescue the Perishing kept coming into my mind too, that you could not stop. I mean, how could you? And what I also remember, which was quite staggering, is I often struggled to get to sleep. But at that time, remember, you hit the pillow, you were out. Next seconds, oh, is it morning already? And you're up again, because we were beyond exhausted. It was such an intense experience.
But the call to rescue these poor birds in need just absolutely trumped all the other needs that you had personally, volunteers had.
It was an absolute, because literally, the African penguins, the entire African penguin species was in danger. It was that serious. If we had done nothing, it would have meant extinction for the African penguins. African penguins are only really congregated around the Cape of Good Hope and mostly in the Atlantic section. And their two biggest colonies were endangered. This was just such a disaster. So from a creation perspective, caring for God's creation, caring for his animals, and try and do some of the damage of careless human beings. The human error here was huge that caused the disaster, but the redemption, the rescue, it's Really, I don't think I've ever been more proud of being a Capetonian than the day we released these penguins back into the wild.
I can just imagine. And for my aunt to have been so willing after such a long journey across the world, literally, to immediately jump in and to volunteer just shows that the need really was greater than our own. And yes, I know that the penguins are thankful.
Well,
even if they weren't at the time, they didn't know what was happening.
Well, I'm sure a lot of the penguins were a bit frustrated with us.
I'm sure.
But when they were released into the wild, and you know, that great day when assembled on the beach at Table Bay, which had been covered in oil just a few months before. And the whole operation was a three-month operation, I should say, time for them all to develop their waterproofing and so on before they were ready. And of course, everything's cleaned and releasing them back in the wild. That was such a celebration. And they went almost like a beeline for the water. And then, and you know, they're awkward on land, but boy, are they fast and sleek in the water.
So what kind of lessons can we learn from this historic ecological disaster and the monumental efforts by all these thoughtful and generous volunteers to rescue over 40,000 penguins, clean up the beaches, rehabilitate those who had been oiled?
Well, I think there's a lot of things. Our success to a large extent was because of the large number of volunteers, 45,000 officially. And the international experts, I believe something like 197 foreign experts or people had some good experience. Some of them were doctoral in marine biology and so on. We definitely did learn from the mistakes made in 94. And the improved transport for the penguins, the rapid arrival at rescue centres of trained, capable of administering emergency care. And the mortality rate, I should say, was less than it would have been if the penguins had been in the wild and hadn't had it. So the loss of penguins, I think in the year 2000, I think we lost less than 67 penguins out of the 40,000 odd, which was much less than it would have lost to natural causes like seals or sharks in the wild during the same time period. Mm. So this was a spectacular success. And to think there were people who said you should have euthanized all oiled penguins, you know, never was an expert more wrong. And so what struck me particularly was without any government help, ordinary people from all walks of life donated time and resources to ensure that the penguins were rescued, cleaned, fed, housed, and released back in the wild safely into cleaned beaches where they were safe. And so I think this has got to be a massive congratulations to SANCOB, to the World Wildlife Fund, to IFAW and other great groups who contributed, because this is magnificent. The worst ecological disaster in South Africa's history was decisively dealt with by volunteers without government help. Too often people are feeling helpless and thinking, I can't do anything without government help. Many people think that way with education. And yet, how many homeschooling parents prove, but you can do a good, you can do a better job than the professionals can with your own children. Who loves your children or understands them better than you do? And so with the ecology, I just think it just showed private free enterprise volunteers are vastly superior to state. I mean, imagine if the state had run this. How, I mean, one shudders to think any government around the world could not have been as efficient as those highly motivated volunteers who came in and we were all willing and ready to be educated. And, you know, if a professor from Salzburg was happy to line up and be instructed in how to behave and treat and handle penguins and how to feed them, and we all came there with a willingness to learn and a desire to help. I do also hope that this would make people think of, we need alternatives to fossil fuels. I pray for the day when cleaner, safer, more environmentally, ecologically friendly forms of energy, I mean, anything is better than bunker fuel and fossil fuel. And so I also look forward to stricter regulation of the seaways to deal with those who are irresponsible and careless in polluting it. We are now approaching, in fact, this day is the day that the MV Treasure sunk 20 years ago. And over the next 3 months, we on the 20th anniversary of that great rescue effort. And I hope it will inspire many to think of our creation mandate, our responsibility to care for God's creation, to fight pollution, to fight plastic pollution in particular, this one-use plastic use and just disposable throwaway stuff. A lot of those plastics end up in the ocean. And you don't want to know how many tons, millions of tons of plastics are polluting our oceans. We've got to stop messing around. We've got to be more serious about ecology and caring, because seabirds are affected by what we litter and pollute and which gets washed into the oceans. So if anybody in Cape Town has not had a chance to visit Sandkop in Milnerton, I'd strongly recommend they look on the website, go over, visit. And
where are they located?
In Milnerton, very easy to find. There's actually, on the main roads, they have the big science. I mean, Sandkop's now a world-renowned institution. And they, by the way, get volunteers, marine biology-type student volunteers coming from Germany and America, and they come there to learn. And they think it's such a privilege to come here and learn. And we can go down the road on a Saturday morning. So this is really a time, I think, to celebrate what Capetonians could do, what animal lovers could do, and to really value our animal rescue organizations like Sandkop.
Well, I, for one, look forward to taking my boys down there and husband and seeing what they've done with the place, because I can just imagine how much it's grown from way back when, 20 years ago.
I didn't mention it. They've now got glass, big glass windows at their surgeries and cleaning rooms, so that a visitor can come and look through and actually see what the doctors are doing and what the cleans are doing. And so you've got an access that we would never have imagined. So you can actually see so much of what's involved there. And they've got great historic pictures. So, yes, a visit to Sandkop is a wonderful opportunity, and they do welcome guests. And they've got a whole lot of interesting collectibles there, which I'm sure people would like to use, because it also contributes towards the costs of running operations like this. There's always little spills, little problems, birds getting caught in nets and so on that they've got to rescue. So there's always a trickle, and every now and then there's a bit of a disaster. But the two we've talked about here, Apollo 94 policy and MV Treasure in year 2000, those were the two colossal, mega, like World War-type disasters from a coastal seabird perspective.
Well, it's very encouraging to know that there's a facility like this where they are fully prepared and equipped for any future disasters and all of the small things as well, all the small little issues that penguins need help with. So where can we see pictures and read more about this epic rescue operation?
Well, we've got a website, www.thebibleandanimals.org. Thebibleandanimals.org. You will see first article up 20 years ago, African Penguin Rescue Operation, and it's got a link to the video. We've got a full video on it. There is a audio of it, a lecture for those who want to listen to the audio presentation where I relate the whole deal. And then there's also the PowerPoint. I've put together the PowerPoint on this, which has got all the pictures we've got of the problem, the disaster, the catastrophe, clean up the rescue, and penguins in natural habitat. And so a person can show this to their children, to their school, a Bible class, maybe a church midweek. And if you've got an animal rescue group in your area that you want to inspire, the PowerPoint's there. So I've put together this PowerPoint on 20 years ago, African Penguin Rescue Operations, all available on the BibleAndAnimals.org website. The article, the pictures, the PowerPoint, the audio, and a video, if you've got the opportunity to share and screen that to others. And I think this is a wonderful opportunity to celebrate. There's a lot of bad news in the world, to celebrate a monumental, magnificent victory over what everyone at the time thought was such a disaster. There was no hope. And it just shows we should never give up hope.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing all your experiences and the stories about these incredible oil spills and the efforts that locals and internationals came around and gathered and rallied to save these poor penguins and all the other birds. So from the front line, we thank you for joining us today, and we hope you have a blessed afternoon.
Thank you. God bless.